Lorraine Lopez, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
And you are a professor at Vanderbilt University. Associate professor, full professor?
Associate.
Are you talking to us from Nashville right now?
Yes, I am. I'm at home. I'm on leave this year, so I'm writing a new novel, and I'm talking to you from home.
Oh, awesome. Are you having a very productive time with your new novel?
Yes. Pretty surprisingly, I made a schedule for myself, and I'm staying to it. In fact, a little bit ahead on it.
So. Nice. And how many pages are you into it, if you can measure it by pages at this point?
Well, I've been on leave this whole semester, and I'll be on leave next semester, so I'm about at the midway point, and I think I'm at the midway point of the novel. I'm about 175 pages in.
Wow. You know, you have the best job in the world. They really love you over there.
It is a good gig. I like it.
But you certainly deserve it. I mean, I think I know your career as, you know, maybe not as well as a Lorraine Lopez scholar, but I've read your first book, Soy La Avon Lady and Other Stories, which won a very important literary prize, and I've read books after that, the Homicide Survivors Picnic, and so much from you. But I have to say, your new novel, The Darling, has who I think is your greatest character yet, Caridad. She is just an amazing character. Gustavo Perez Firmat writes, she's Madame Bovary in huaraches and jeans.
Yes.
Which is a wonderful quote. Tell me, how did she come about, Caridad? How did Caridad come about? And what can you tell us about her?
Well, I wanted to, the whole idea for the novel came to me as an idea about cross-dressing, which is
really
something I'm very interested in. And for Caridad, she's also interested as well in the way that male authors, canonical white, mm-hmm. dead white male authors, assume female identities through creating protagonists mm-hmm. who are women and writing the female perspective. They're liberated from their male bodies by imagination
right.
to inhabit a female perspective. So she is very naive, and she takes what they've written as life lessons, as if they know more about being a woman than she does.
Right.
Because she's a young female who's compromised in her authority. And that's where the idea came from. I was just interested in this young woman who has this young woman's insecurity and unsureness about herself, and gleaning what it means to be a woman from dead white men.
Wow. You know, that explains a lot. If you look at the first line of the novel, which is a great first line, it says, on her wedding day, Caridad Delgado pined for a dead man.
Yes.
I love that first line. And yeah, she has these relationships with dead men. And it's more than just a reader-writer relationship, but she has they're very real relationships, or at least in her imagination, with Anton Chekhov, Flaubert, Dreiser, D.H. Lawrence, Nabokov, Thomas Hardy. And these relationships that she has very much parallel male-female relationships in general.
Yes, that's true. There's a part of the book where she's reading, I think it's Theodore Dreiser, like medicine prescribed for a particular ailment. And this is the lens by which she's viewing her life, but also her relationships. And in one sense, this lens is obfuscating her viewpoint, and it's preventing her from seeing things.
Right.
But it's also a useful measuring stick and enables her to see when things are not anywhere near what they could be, and helps her to back off and say, this is not what I thought it was at all.
And what's really wonderful about this metaphorical landscape, going from writer to writer, learning what she can from them, and then falling out of love, falling in love with the next one, and then falling out of love, she kind of does this with her real relationships as well. And there is a definite parallel with the relationship she has with men in this. Is there a difference between her relationships with the dead men and her relationships with the live men?
Well, there are. I would say her relationships with the authors that she reveres are more constant, and she's more faithful to them and loyal to them than she can be to the
right.
human men in her life. They don't disappoint her. They are what they are. And she's come to accept that. And she understands that they're limited over time. What they can offer her is limited. But that doesn't diminish her ardor.
Right, right.
She's the last, it's no spoiler, it's not a thriller, you know, the last part of the book is a plan to keep them near. And she can leave the humans behind, but always have the authors with her.
Right. And I mentioned some of the names, dead men that she falls in love with. I like saying it that way, dead men she falls in love with. Chekhov, Flaubert, Dreiser, Lawrence, Nabokov, Hardy, all fiction writers. Chekhov, of course, is known for his groundbreaking short stories that almost even define what we think of as short story form even today. But I want to ask, what do these writers specifically mean to her? Why does she fall in love with these men?
These are authors she's come across through her, initially, through reading lists in college.
Uh-huh.
This is how she first encountered them. But she may not be able to see this or articulate it,
right,
or understand it, or maybe when she gets older, she will. But she's interested in that they're writing the female perspective.
Right.
Except for Nabokov, who really moves her profoundly,
right,
probably has the strongest impact on her, in just in terms of being a master craftsman of prose. She really loves Nabokov, but they're inhabiting a female perspective, and the titles of their books are generally women's names. That's what she's drawn to. She's trying to figure out, how do I live as a woman?
In fact, the title of the novel itself, The Darling, comes from the title of a short story by Anton Chekhov.
Right, right. And it's a nice parallel. I love that story. I actually read it when I was an undergraduate in college. I've never forgotten it. And I read it over and over. I love that story. And it's about a woman who doesn't have an identity, and so she keeps assuming the identity of the men that she marries.
Well, you know, that's really interesting that she would seek out dead males in this case to define herself, to find out who she is. And at first, you know, I think, as you alluded to, somewhat of a naive way to go about it.
Right.
But not to spoil it, but you said it's not a detective novel. But does her relationship with these men and with the images that they portray of women, or the way they embody a woman, does she ultimately begin to question it, and does that parallel her own growth, intellectual, spiritual growth?
Right, yes, she does. And there's a point at which she feels disappointed with Hardy, as a matter of fact, and James, who neglect to describe how their protagonists deal with being mothers. They introduce these infants, they have them give birth, and then something happens, the infant dies.
Right.
As if they can't, their imagination cannot make that leap. And she, who, you know, eventually has a child, understands that they can't write that. So they do away with the baby.
Right.
They can't describe. And she's beginning to see, okay, I've got to this stage with them, but I can't really go much further.
And, you know, I think human development is not necessarily just spiritual or intellectual or emotional or even artistic. I think when you develop in all those areas, and they have their own manifestations, depending on what you're applying it to. But I remember hearing, I don't know if you remember this song by Bruce Cockburn. I forget the name of it, but he goes, "Here come the helicopters, second time today." The whole refrain is, you know, "If I had a rocket launcher, some son of a beep would die." Do you remember that song?
No, I don't. It sounds great.
Well, it was. I thought it was the most brilliant intellectual song in the world. And I listened to it again about 2 weeks ago. I thought, my God, this is superficial. This is really silly. And I'm wondering, are there any of those authors that she ultimately begins to say, you know what, you betrayed me. You're really kind of superficial, and I don't want anything to do with you anymore.
There's D.H. Lawrence. She has an issue with D.H. Lawrence because he has a moment in Lady Chatterley's Lover where he's in Lady Chatterley's perspective,
uh-huh,
and she's listening to her. I don't know if you remember the book. Her husband, Clifford, is an invalid who's he's kind of a narcissist and horrible person, and she's overhearing Clifford with his friends discussing women, how women feel, and she's aware of how fatuous they sound. And so Caridad, in the novel, realizes that Lawrence is doing the very same thing.
Wow.
And he sounds fatuous, too.
Even though the story on many levels is about her relationships with dead men and living men, it's also about her relationships with women. She grows up in a house full of women. How does that affect her and who she is and her development?
Well, I think that there's a certain causality there. I think she feels that the examples proffered by her sisters, one who is so prickly that she is difficult to be around, for anyone to be around, so she doesn't have relationships with men, and the other who's so pliant that she's practically a cipher, and her mother who's kind of got this romantic ideal and doesn't really fully face the fact that she's been deserted by her husband, the betrayal of that. So she feels that those examples have let her down, and this is partly why she's gone to classic literature to find out how to be in the world, and the fact that her father is gone. She's never met her father, so she's looking for male authority. And this is something that unfortunately women will do. If women have, one of my colleagues wrote a book about women in prison and how they claim to have had supernatural experiences.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things they all do is get male verification of it, in the telling of it. And so I told my brother, and my brother saw this, or my father noticed that. And that makes it real somehow. So men have to verify for so many women, and it's our culture. We're steeped in it. Even if we don't see it, it's very powerful. So she's looking for male approbation, and she's not. And she's an intellectual. She's a silly, immature, and foolish. And that's where do you go when you're an intellectual?
Right.
You go to books. You go to classic literature. And actually, on a pragmatic note, the novel gave me an excuse to revisit all the books that I love so much.
Right.
So I got to read them all over again.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, you know, and just to kind of coattail a little bit on what you're saying about how her experience with lack of men and growing up with women have affected her relationships, there's also, you know, the fact that she is attracted to older men. And in this case, of course, some of those older men are very old and very dead. But that, too, is kind of, on some level, not a search for, perhaps, maybe that's too strong, but a identification with a father figure.
Right, right. She does need that. She needs that input in her life, whether she, you know, admits it to herself or not.
And let's look at the names of her sisters, Esperanza and Felicia. You know, Esperanza, of course, means hope in Spanish, and Felicia, I assume, is etymologically linked with feliz, with happiness.
Right.
And her name is Caridad, which means charity.
Right.
And I think of the charity as in love, as in, you know, the King James Version of Corinthians chapter, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, charity suffereth long and is kind, charity envieth not, charity blah, blah, blah. And she kind of fits that idea, at least in terms of her search. She seems to be more concerned with love, was more concerned with charity. When you named these characters, was it a conscious choice to name them to reflect or to subvert their characters, or was it just something that happened organically?
Well, I was pretty intentional, I admit, about the names, and I tend to be about names. And in this case, I intended them ironically.
Uh-huh.
Alicia, for example, is very bitter. And very antagonistic. There's not much happiness there. And Esperanza is hope in the most ironic sense. She's in a very hopeless and miserable relationship, and she goes back to it after a while.
Right.
So she is not especially hopeful, though she does tend to have a more positive outlook, though her body is beginning to betray her with, you know, hypertension and so forth. And I didn't think Caridad was especially charitable. One of the things I liked about her, that I like about her still, is her selfishness, is her ability to do what Esperanza can't do, and that's to say, nope, not what I want. I'm walking away, and I'm not looking back. I'm going to find what I want.
you know, like I was saying, I don't think it reflects the word charity in the way we use it, but more in an older, you know, dead white man way. You know, charity as the word for love, or as, you know, you can replace that word with love, as opposed to charity as we think about, you know, giving and, you know, volunteering and all that stuff.
I like the suffering part.
I love the detail with one of her relationships. She marries a man named Jorge. Jorge decides to invite his best friend on their honeymoon. And this is a weird and wonderful detail. How did this come about? And how did you make it believable?
Well, I had this relationship. I was really concerned, to be honest with you, if that relationship would fly. It would seem plausible, his relationship with his friend. I have seen friendships between people that just doesn't make sense why this person would have so much influence over another person, more than the wife, more than the mother, you know, just this, this friendship. And that's what I was aiming for, and I'm glad to hear you say it's plausible, because I was concerned about that. But his friend was really the arbiter of what Jorge would do, how he would behave. He even, you know, he goes beyond taking him on his honeymoon. It's Noah's idea to do the open marriage. So he's got his eye on Caridad.
Right.
And Jorge doesn't see it. He's blinded by this connection he has to his friend.
I think it also works on a the level of character that she would fall for somebody who really seeks male approval.
Right. And with this very obnoxious, pedantic person that he can't see through. Yeah, I love the honeymoon. I love the bringing the friend on the honeymoon.
That really struck me as a quite original detail. But like I said, it's very believable, especially, you know, if, you know, plot equals character over time. You know, if it's her character that would allow something to exist. It seems very organic. Do you mind talking about the questions Caridad asks herself about whether or not she's flying or falling when she thinks of herself as a trapeze artist? That's a wonderful metaphor. And
thank you.
Can you explain that to us?
I'll try.
Okay.
She has a sense of movement. She's thinking, you know, I'm leaving this situation and going on to that situation, knowing full well that situation A has too many shortcomings, is just not a good fit for her at all. She has no idea what situation B will hold. So all she has a sense of is movement. I'm moving, and I don't know which direction. I don't know if I'm flying, if I'm falling, if I'm just moving laterally. I just know that I need to move.
And that's interesting, because the need to move without a direction is in many ways the definition of play, to play, to have fun. But it doesn't seem that her movement is necessarily providing much fun for her. She moves, but is she moving? And this may be a very male question to ask as I think about it now. Is she moving towards any particular concrete goal?
She's moving toward herself and toward knowing how to be in the world. All of these are steps. I think of it as a journey, the novel as a journey toward self-discovery.
Absolutely.
To finding yourself. And it's almost, to be most reductive and simplistic, like Goldilocks, this is too big, this is too small, this is finding one's place and understanding who one is in the world. So that's what she's after. It probably could be clearer in the novel.
I don't think so. I don't think you want it to be too clear. I think the way it is perfect. You know that when I first read this novel, because I think I discussed it with you, that I kind of read it as a portrait of the artist kind of development. And you can't separate artistic development with, you know, emotional, mental, intellectual development.
That was a really kind thing to say. I was happy to hear that.
I don't like to ask people, are you writing about yourself? Because I've been asked that so many times, even with characters that are complete jerks and buttholes that I wouldn't want in my life. She reads a lot. She's a compulsive reader, and you made an allusion earlier to how wonderful it was to be able to rediscover these books that you read when you were a college student, I think an undergrad and maybe even a grad student. Do you read as much as her? And is that obsession of hers to read and go from book to book, is that something that you share with her?
Yes, it is. I do read a lot. That's one of the joys of being on leave. I can read what I want to read. I will read at least 2 or 3 hours every day.
Oh, my God.
In fact, I've figured out that I can't read in the morning, because if I start to read in the morning, I will do nothing else all day.
Wow.
I'll have no desire to do anything but read. So, yes, I do like my character. I do love to read, and I always have.
Do you find that there's a conflict between the two readers that you have to be for who you are? You know, you're one reader because you love to read, and you get lost, I assume, in the landscape, and you just, you know, you're in there, and you don't want to leave. But then you're also a professor of literature, and there might be times, perhaps, when you read, and it's not as fun because you're looking for things.
Right. Well, I don't mind that. If I'm reading a book that I'm teaching and I'm looking for things, I enjoy that too. Mm. I do enjoy that a lot. What I don't enjoy reading are papers.
I can relate to that.
I mean, sometimes you do have one that's just really sparkling, brilliant. But more often than not, it's that you have to pronounce a judgment on it, and that weighs on you, and you're trying to find something hopeful and encouraging, and it can be hard.
Yeah, I know how that feels. I teach, I'm in a creative writing program, so I don't have to teach literature courses unless they're, you know, craft courses. But nonetheless, that doesn't mean I never assign papers. And when I do, it's like I put it off and I put it off, and I'll read just to escape from that.
Yes.
The name of the book is The Darling. It's by Lorraine M. Lopez. I hope people pick this up. It's a beautiful novel. Congratulations on
this. Thank you. Thank you so much, Dan.
And thank you for joining me on Words on the Wire.
Well, thank you for having me.